Just start. Thank you. So that is a weird, we're just starting. Welcome to Sunday night. There is a solution. Newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Today is December the 22nd, 2024. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Our speaker today is a compulsive overeater and a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the big book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After she shares, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what she has shared. Please help me welcome Eva, a compulsive overeater from Toronto.
Hi, everyone. Compulsive overeater, anorexic, bulimic. My name is Eva. Thanks so much. I'm scared to death. That's okay. It's a good scared because it's a scared that tells me I don't have it all together. I never have to have it all together. And I have a higher power who I can turn to help me one day at a time to show up for life and to work this program to the best of my ability. I'm glad to be doing this right before Christmas. I celebrate Christmas. One of the first miracles, my life has been so full of miracles. One of the first miracles I want to share is that on December 22nd, I have not eaten too much, drunk too much, spent too much, or talked too much. I am sitting here peacefully abstinent, and I'm so grateful for that. And I'm really glad to be of service because the big book makes it very clear that recovered person working with another is vital. It's absolutely vital to permanent recovery. And I know the horrors of compulsive eating, anorexia, and bulimia. I lived it for a long, long time, and I don't ever want to go back there. And one day at a time, when I work this program and I do the do things that the big book tells me to do, that's what happens. I live in recovery today. So a little bit of my stats. I have a very interesting story. That's okay. When I walked into this program, I was 17 years old in high school, and now I'm in my 60s. So I have spent my entire life in this program. Every stage of life has been walked out in recovery, working with a sponsor, working the steps. And I am just so, so grateful for that. So my interesting story is that even though I walked into the doors of OA in 1978, my actual abstinent state is August 6th, 1994. And this past August, I just celebrated 30 years. And yes, it's still a miracle to me. I still remember the night when I finally conceded defeat. And I stepped out in faith and I put my trust in this recovery program. I put my trust in what people had said to me, the recovered people around me that said, if you do what we do, you also will be free of food one day at a time. And as a compulsive overeater, anorexic, bulimic, you know, I walked in the doors of OA not with a large amount of weight to lose because I was very good at manipulating calories, calorie intake, output. I knew sodium, I knew carbohydrate, I knew trans fat. Like I just knew it all. But I was really, really miserable. I was just so miserable and I was so trapped. I just felt like I felt like my life had no, I had no choices left. All of my choices were about how I was going to keep my addiction alive. What did I need to do to get rid of the binge, start the binge, control the binge, get the weight off, how much exercise, how much biking, how much time at the gym. It was just nightmarish. It was completely nightmarish. And anyway, so I'm talking a little bit about that, but I'll go even farther back. So I was born here in Toronto to immigrant parents. I grew up in a lot of trauma. My mom committed suicide when I was a little girl, and then I ended up in foster care for about 3 or 4 years. When I came back home, my father, who had fought, my father has, I can say this now, and this is as a result of steps 8 and 9. My father had the most unbelievable, fantastic life. His story could have really made a script, a movie script. But he had been traumatized by everything that had happened in Eastern Europe, and he had fought during the Second World War. And when he came back, he was a really, really angry, bitter man. And he took out all that anger and bitterness on the people around him. I was fortunate. When I look back now, I see my higher power. Even before I knew there was a higher power or had a higher power whom I choose to call God, even before I had a God working in my life, God was working in my life. And my dad remarried, and I was able to return home. But I returned home to a very tense, fearful, unpredictable, chaotic home environment. I never felt safe. I never felt safe physically, emotionally, intellectually. I realized now when I did inventory work that a lot of my anorexia just came from this desire to want to hide. If I get little, really little, nobody will notice me. Nobody will hurt me. A lot of that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of pain. But in the middle of all that pain, at 5 years old, I had to have my tonsils taken out, and I went to the hospital. And when I was after this surgery, the doctor said, "Give her everything that's cold and sweet." And that's how it got started, was all. And I don't need to go into, I don't need to name specific foods, but that's when I discovered that certain foods and certain sugar levels in foods triggered a sense of safety and ease and comfort. And that's how it started at 5 years old. And those food substances gave me a feeling of security and happiness that I was not finding at home. And in my early years, before I discovered anorexia and bulimia, I was an extremely chubby child. I remember grade 7 being weighed by the school nurse and being the heaviest child in my class, and just the shame and my classmates. I mean, we're talking 7 years old here, but my classmates all saying, "I wonder how much she weighs. I wonder how much she weighs. I wonder how much she weighs," which was so traumatic for me as a 7-year-old. So I internalized that pain. Like, I just felt like I'm ET and I just want to go home. I'm not, this is, I don't fit here. I don't think like these people. I don't eat like these people. I'm not like these people. So there was a tremendous amount of loneliness in my early childhood. And again, the food took away the pain of the loneliness. The loneliness I felt at home, and the loneliness I felt with my classmates, that I don't think like them. I knew even then that there was something about my relationship with food that wasn't like their relationship with food. Even before I crossed the line, and that will come later on down the road, I always felt like food had some kind of magical power. It had a magical power. And at 7 years old, of course, I believe in Santa Claus and I believe in magical powers. So anyway, I continued eating compulsively. I had plenty of pictures of me as a very young child, sort of, like I said, 5 to about 11 or 12, quite obese. And then I'm not really quite sure what happened at about 12 or 13. During the summer months, a neighbor of ours would rent their cottage to my family, up in the Bob Cage and Kawartha area. And I went up there, and I became absolutely infatuated with, and I'm like 12 or 13 years old, and I'm infatuated with Vogue magazine and Harper's Bazaar and all these skinny mini models. And I just put as much energy as I could as a 12, 13 year old to finding out more about dieting. And I want to look, happiness will start when I look like those really slim, gorgeous women. And so I remember at about the age of 12 or 13 that I started dieting. I there was no internet. I don't know how I got my hands on all these books. Maybe it was in these magazines, Mademoiselle, Harper's, Vogue. They had, they had all these diets, as well as fashion, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so that summer I took off a lot of weight. Probably about 30 or 40 pounds. I came back home, and of course, everybody noticed and said, "Oh my gosh, look at how different you look." However, as I mentioned, it was at that time that I crossed the line. And the big book talks about, the normal drinker, the heavy drinker, and the drinker who crosses the line. And I, in that summer, 12 or 13, is when I crossed the line. What I mean by that is that after this summer of dieting and looking amazing, and being, my dad was never there. So I was kind of in this bubble on this beautiful, at this beautiful cottage, just my mom, my brother, and I. And I return back home and I'm no longer in the bubble. I'm now back in reality. And the reality is, my unhappy home situation, all the family dynamics, I start to become depressed. I become afraid. And I remember clearly, very shortly after we got back home, starting to feel that old, horrible anxiousness again, depression, fear, everything. And, but I had been on a diet and I didn't want anybody to see what I was doing. And so I remember sneaking into one of the rooms in my house where I know my mom kept binge food, and I remember sneaking that food really quietly so nobody would hear what I was doing. And that started, for me, a lot of shame and pain and remorse around what I was doing. I think up until that time, even though I was a chubby child, I wasn't sneaky or hiding around the food. I didn't have a lot of, I didn't like the way I looked, but I wasn't ashamed of the way I ate. And after that episode, when I snuck off and tried to get my food without anybody noticing, I started to feel a lot of fear and just confusion around what I was doing. I'm like, I know how to diet. I know how to get my weight down to a normal body size. Why am I doing this? Like, I was so confused. Why am I doing this? Anyway, the teen years are challenging enough as it is. And as I mentioned earlier, I started, thankfully, OA quite young, but at about, and I really believe, again, even though I didn't see it at the time, this is a gift from my higher power, is that at the age of 16, 17, I got a job working at Laura Secord. And yeah, Laura Secord, for somebody like me, was, how do I describe it? It was wonderful and it was terrible at the same time. And all of the things that people, you know, my coworkers said to me, you'll get tired of it, you won't notice it after a while. That's how I know I'm bodily, mentally different, is that I never got tired of it. And the same sneaking and hiding that I had done as a 13-year-old, I started to do in my workplace. So I would come to work after school, and I would, you know, do all the things I was supposed to do. And then as soon as nobody was looking, I would start to reach my hands into the counters and start eating. And then if people were at the front of the store, and this is all part of my story, I would actually go to the garbage, like where they would cut off the bits that weren't sort of presentable for the public. I would go into the garbage and I would pull all that stuff out and start eating. So that I think gives you a sense of where I was at, physically, emotionally. As I mentioned, I was very confused. I was anxious. I was depressed already. I had very low self-esteem. I felt like a victim. I felt like I was like everybody out there somehow had the secret answer to life, and I was a victim, and I just wandered around really, really lost. Anyway, and for whatever reason, you know, in the back of my mind, I said, you know, I'm eating this way. There's something wrong with the way I eat. And I started researching it. And I actually went to a diet club at about 16 or 17. And I was the youngest one there. And I heard what they had to say. And it just, I'm like, well, first of all, it's like, I don't want to eat like that. That's awful. I don't want to eat like that. And, but I knew that I didn't want to be overweight. And I couldn't figure out why I was eating so much, gaining weight, and then having to lose it. I read a huge article in the Toronto Star, that talked about Overeaters Anonymous. So it took me months to get up the nerve to go. And I never told anybody about it. I never told anybody about the way I ate. When I was in high school, I was friends with women. My fellow students were all gorgeous and slim and tall and blonde. And again, I didn't fit in. And when they overate, they had no remorse or regret. It was easy. They would just get on with their life the next morning, and not me. For me, I just had so much shame about food. And I just thought, well, there's something wrong with me. And it's got to do with the way I'm eating. So if I can just control my food, then I'll fit in. Everything will be okay. So anyway, I read this article. It took me months to finally go. I didn't have a clue what I was getting into. I went to my very first meeting, and you know, again, one of the miracles happened for me, and that was that when I was standing, this was at Glebe Church, which is a Glebe and Young, which is closed now. And when I was standing there, I'm pretty sure it was in the spring, I was afraid to walk into the door. And there's a story in the big book where he sort of experiences the same type of thing, afraid to walk into the meeting, like, what am I going to find? And when I was standing at the door, about to sort of indecisive as to whether scared, whether to walk in, another young woman my age, so I'm 17 and she's 18, walked up and said, have you ever been to this before? And I said, no. You? She goes, no. She goes, let's go in together. And that was a miracle. Like, I don't know what would have happened if she hadn't showed up, because I was really scared. and afraid to walk through the doors, what I would find. And at 17, I was pretty young. But that kind of tells you how desperate I was, that at 17 I was willing to try it. Like, I didn't have a clue what I was doing or where I was going, but and why I'm in this church basement of this church that I don't even go to. I don't belong to this religion, but I thought, okay, I'll try it. So anyway, my first meeting was, again, not just a miracle because of this young woman who happened to be there. It was a miracle because when I heard people in the room, and I'm 17, and probably the youngest person there was maybe 30, and I felt like they're really old and they don't understand me, but I didn't care. But when I heard them talk, the way they talked about food, I was like stunned. I was like, I felt like this huge weight lifted off of me. And it was like a spiritual awakening for me. It was like a miracle because I didn't feel alone anymore. That constant chronic loneliness that I lived with my entire life, it's like it was gone. I said, oh my God, these people understand. I don't have to lie or hide or feel ashamed. I don't have to be confused. Like, there's other people in the world who feel like me. Holy smokes. So anyway, as I mentioned earlier, I'd like to say that I recovered right away. But it was late 70s, early 80s. This is way, way, way before vision. And everybody was kind of really, really doing the best they could. I don't know that there was a lot of abstinence. And to be honest, I think at 17 or 18, I don't know if I would have been, I don't know. I realize now in retrospect, I hadn't hit a bottom. It took a long time for me to hit a bottom. So I
That's
went
10
from,
minutes left, Eva.
oh, great, thank you. So I spent a lot of years going to meetings, having fellowship, going to conferences, conventions, being in the rooms. I spent a lot of time in the rooms, but I did not have recovery. I did not. Recovery is fellowship and the steps. And I had lots of fellowship and no steps. So, anyway, fast forward, the disease is progressive. The binges got worse. And it's very, very, very painful to be in a 12-step meeting and knowing that I'm come to a meeting and not abstinent, or that I'm leaving a meeting and I'm planning to go and binge. That was very painful, very hard. And but it took what it took. And fine, but the disease is progressive. The binges got worse. It got harder and harder and harder to control my eating. And I talked to people, but I did not get that message of depth and weight that the big book talks about. So now I'm going to talk about recovery. In 1994, I, through a lot of circumstances, I really, really hit bottom. I realized that, just as the big book says, and in the doctor's opinion, I realized that I had a disease not only of my mind, but as well as my body. I have an allergy, and an allergy for me is simply an abnormal reaction. I have an abnormal reaction to certain foods or food behaviors, alcoholic foods or alcoholic behaviors, that the normal eater doesn't have. I have a mind that will constantly lie to me. I've shared it before. I have allergies to ASA, aspirin, and I discovered that by having a very severe reaction. And I've never taken ASA since. But when I see what happens to me when I pick up the first compulsive bite and still go back over and over and over again, that means that I have a problem in my thinking as well as in my body. So in that, by acknowledging that, I recognize I took step one, that I was powerless, that I would always be powerless. And that because I'm powerless, my life will always be unmanageable. Which is why I've come to realize that I need, one day at a time, to incorporate and practice this design for living to the best of my ability, because I will always be powerless over food and I will always have an unmanageable life. Step two for me was quite a, It was a real challenge because I grew up in a religious home. I went to church. I did all those things, but it was a dead, lifeless religion. It had no meaning to me. And I equated spirituality with that dead religion. And it was only through talking to others and reading the big book and talking to and working with a recovered sponsor that I discovered that I could start on a very exciting new journey to find a higher power that really, really worked for me, and higher power that cared as much about the state of the world as about my struggle to not pick up alcoholic foods and food behaviors, that my higher power wasn't out there. My higher power is in here, and in the rooms and in the faces of the people around me. And I continue to grow in that relationship with my higher power. It's very exciting. Step three, really, I always thought it was really hard. It wasn't. I mean, it was hard, but it's not. I mean, these steps are simple, but they're not easy. Step three for me was making the decision. It was making the decision that I would incorporate this new spiritual way of life. That's how, that this spiritual way of life was what I was going to commit to one day at a time. How? By practicing the rest of the steps. And it's a daily decision for me. Every time I work the steps, I'm doing my third step. Step four was incredible. I had so much fear and resentment, and I discovered the fear. Most of my resentment was really fear in disguise. And being able to honestly share that with another person led to such a, my fifth step was absolutely fantastic. And I received that miracle that they talk about in the big book, where I really had that sense of walking on the broad highway of the universe. Six and seven for me is a daily challenge. It's something I need to constantly do, and that is to be willing to look to when I uncover defects, to be willing to surrender them to something greater than me that can change me one day at a time. Steps eight and nine as well too were a real challenge. My step eight and nine, my ninth step with my father, I'd love to tell you it was like, you know, stars and flowers. It wasn't. He did not receive it, but it still changed me. It was incredible. So today I live in steps 11, 11, 10, 11, and 12. I do tenths when I need them. Sorry, how much time do I have? Lacey? Is it Lacey that's timing
Sorry,
me?
Eva, I couldn't unmute for some reason. Yes, let me check for you exactly. You have 3 minutes and 48 seconds.
Awesome. Okay, so that's perfect. So today I live in 10, 11, and 12. I must do tenths on it. Like I had to do a tenth and I sent it to my sponsor right before just because that's who I am. Because I love myself enough to not want to live in negative emotions. Negative emotions are for normal people. They're not for me. I can't deal with them. Step 11 to me is tied into my step two and step three. And that is conscious contact, trusting that I'm going to get the power to do my higher power's will, and just growing in that relationship. And then step 12. So I'm just going to, I had asked if I could read this. I love the AA description of step 12, and this is what I want to share. And for me, it's the freedom. I just have so much freedom around food today. I'm unbelievably grateful for it, just so grateful. So it says, the joy of living is the theme of the AA's 12th step, and action is its key word. Here we turn outward toward our fellow alcoholics who are still in distress. Here we experience the kind of giving that asks no reward. That asks no rewards. And what I want to go on to say here is that maybe, oh, sorry, okay, the paragraph is here. Maybe there are as many definitions of a spiritual awakening as there are people who've had them, but certainly each genuine one has something in common with all others. And these things which we have in common are not too hard to understand. When a man or woman has a spiritual awakening, the most important meaning of it is that he, Eva, has now become able to do, feel, and believe that which I could not do before on my unaided strength and resources alone. I have been, I'm changing it to I, obviously. I have been granted a gift which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. I have been set on a path which tells me that I'm really going somewhere, that life is not a dead end, not something to be endured or mastered. In a very real sense, I've been transformed because I've laid hold of a source of strength, which in one way or another I had hitherto denied myself. I find myself in possession of a degree of honesty, tolerance, unselfishness, peace of mind, and love of which I had thought myself quite incapable. What I have received is a free gift, and yet usually, at least in some small part, I've made myself ready to receive it. Okay, I'm done. Thanks for letting me share.
Oh, well, thank you very much.